It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Western Wisconsin is losing some healthcare options without a lot of warning. Hospital Sisters Health System and Previa Health are closing down operations in the region, including doctor's offices and two hospitals. A week from today, according to the schedule, Sacred Heart Hospital in Eau Claire and St. Joseph Hospital in Chippewa Falls will officially close, along with a network of primary and specialty care clinics. Nearly 1,400 employees are expected to be laid off. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in Eau Claire or the Chippewa Valley? Will these closures affect you and your health care directly? Do you work in one of the affected hospitals or clinics? And if you're not in that area, have you seen healthcare options close in your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Hope Kerwin is WPR's lacrosse-based reporter. She's been writing about these hospital and clinic closures. Hope, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Hope, as I understand it, this caught a lot of people kind of off guard. Can you give us the timeline of why this seemed to happen so abruptly?
Yeah, that's been a question that local officials have kind of echoed again and again since these closures were announced on January 22nd. They've really kind of questioned the accelerated timeline for this. At the time, HSHS had said that, you know, they were making this decision to leave Western Wisconsin because of prolonged operational and financial stress, which they said was related to kind of the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, inflation, workforce constraints, what they described as local market challenges. So kind of citing a variety of reasons there. But local officials have really questioned, well, you know, why they weren't given additional warning beyond that 60-day notice that's required for layoffs.
Now, two hospitals, a healthcare system, this clearly is going to affect, I imagine, Hope, a lot of patients. Do we know what's happening to have them replace that medical care?
Yeah, HSHS has said and even reiterated Monday that they are working to kind of ensure that these patient care transitions are happening, kind of in a well-planned and safe manner. They even said on Monday that they're working with the State Department of Health Services on those. But there's been a lot of questions about, you know, whether the other healthcare providers in that region, several of them in Eau Claire, if they have the capacity to kind of take on all of these additional patients that are going to be needing care, and especially in rural areas, which is where we, you know, a lot of those Previa primary and specialty care clinics, you know, those patients that are being seen in rural communities, they're probably going to have to travel farther or, you know, kind of see new providers in different communities.
Before this announcement, the state legislature had set aside $15 million aimed at expanding psychiatric care in Western Wisconsin. Now, I understand there's maybe a scramble to use that money for some of the emergency needs here. What is going on with that?
Yeah, so the state legislature worked really quickly to approve that $15 million for initially emergency department expansions. Now, Governor Tony Evers, he about 2 weeks ago used his partial veto power to allow that money to be used for other services. Where that kind of stands is the Joint Finance Committee has to release that funding to the State Department of Health Services. They've yet to do that at this point. We've seen, you know, the governor urge the JFC twice now this week to go ahead and release that funding. So that's kind of where that funding lies right now.
A lot of people up in the air now, patients, staff, and more. Hope, what are you watching for next in this story?
Yeah, it'll just be really interesting, I think, all of the different kind of domino effect of these closures. I've been talking with different county health officials or different county officials about kind of the different impacts, everything from, you know, Chippewa County used St. Joseph's as their primary morgue. And so now they're having to find a new place to, you know, if they need to store a body or, you know, do further examination, you know, they have to find a new place to do that. So there's all these small impacts, you know, that's not really small, but, you know, these other impacts that are happening because of the closures that I think, you know, even the community doesn't quite know exactly what all of those are going to be yet.
Hope, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Hope Kerwin is a reporter here at WPR. She talked to us about hospital closures, two of them in Western Wisconsin, effective a week from now. Now the head of a Wisconsin hospital organization joins us for a look at the challenges facing hospitals, including in smaller cities and rural areas. 195 hospitals in rural parts of the country have closed recently, according to research from the University of North Carolina. That doesn't include these newly announced closures in western Wisconsin. Eric Borgeting is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Hospital Association. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Before we look more specifically at Western Wisconsin, Eric, what are some of the challenges that are behind this trend that's leading a lot of rural and smaller town hospitals to close?
Well, it's a combination of things. I loathe continuing to look back at the pandemic. But I think what if I had to point to one continuing effect of the pandemic on healthcare delivery, I would say that it took a number of challenges that were out there, and there's, you know, many, and it sort of exacerbated them all, and then it accelerated them. And so you had workforce issues, you had the cost of delivering care, issues related to difficulty being able to discharge patients out of hospitals, especially to nursing homes, reimbursement related issues, demographics, and a few others. And those are not new. None of those are new. But I will say when COVID hit, all of them became worse, and they became worse at the same time. And that makes addressing those issues very difficult. And I would also say that the challenges that existed prior to COVID, they haven't necessarily improved. Most of the things I just mentioned are still significant challenges. And that includes, by the way, hospitals, which are so critical to their communities, as we're seeing play out, and we've seen play out in other parts of the state, really having to step in and fill a lot of gaps in sort of the public health space or the sort of community health and community response space, and still having to do some of those things. So I wish I could pinpoint one thing. Happy to talk about any of those, but and it's not just in Eau Claire. Mm-hmm. While I think the impacts of those things are clearly currently the most acute in Eau Claire, we've been seeing signs of stress throughout the pandemic in other communities as well.
I'll dig into some of those deeper issues. I want to focus in on Eau Claire and the Chippewa Falls area as well. Now, we've got these hospitals closing. Now, I'm reading, Eric, that other hospitals, other healthcare providers are going to try to add beds, add services to help meet some of the needs. That sounds like something that, you know, would take months at least to do, maybe years. How big a challenge would it be for other providers in the area to try to fill this gap in a timely way?
No, I think it is. It's a significant challenge. I believe it's one of the reasons the legislature focused on what it believed and what it was hearing, particularly from folks locally, was the most urgent of many, frankly, urgent needs. And that was emergency room and emergency department capacity with the legislation. It will take time to try and replace all of that lost capacity and all of those services that, you know, took years to build up and years to try and sustain. I am optimistic and encouraged by seeing the two hospitals there, the Mayo and the Marshfield Clinic facilities, really the two community sort of safety net hospitals in that community, step up as rapidly as they can. You know, they face similar challenges that all hospitals do with workforce and things like that are called payer mix, which we can talk about maybe. But I think it's improving. There's no question about it. I think there's a little more optimism today than there was, you know, a few weeks ago. But it's going to take time, especially in services like mental health and substance use treatment. Those are very difficult services to stand up and to sustain. And we saw that even preceding, might say precipitating, the news about HSHS closing those two facilities. There were signs that this was that there were some concerns and strain there when HSHS ultimately was not able to utilize the $15 million that had been made available for capital expense, bricks and mortar, if you will, to expand behavioral health and substance use care. Those dollars weren't used because at the end of the day, I believe HSHS determined that it could not operate an expanded, that expanded capacity. So that's, in my opinion, and there are others that have, you know, opinions about this, of course, but in my opinion, that's going to be, that capacity is going to be the most difficult to try and backfill, certainly anytime soon.
We're talking to Eric Borgerding, President and CEO of the Wisconsin Hospital Association, about hospital closures in Western Wisconsin, two of them closing in a week, and the challenges facing hospitals, especially in smaller cities and rural communities. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a rural community? Where is the nearest hospital to you? Are you personally affected by these closures in Western Wisconsin as a patient, as an employee? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Eric Borgerding, President and CEO of the Wisconsin Hospital Association, looking at the closures of hospitals and clinics in Western Wisconsin, what that'll mean for people who are losing their current providers, and wider challenges facing hospitals, especially in smaller towns, rural communities. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have? Are we talking about you as a patient or a provider yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I live directly adjacent to this kind of goings-on with both of these hospitals closing. And I guess my question is there something legislative that could have been done or should have been done? And then also, is it a private equity problem? Is that something? And if that's the case, I'm a little hesitant about dumping a bunch of state money into a private equity problem. And then I guess thirdly, don't communities kind of game plan or do a risk assessment if various things kind of go belly up in the community that are privately owned?
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there, Eric. First of all, the private equity and healthcare issue, this is something that I think you've talked about elsewhere. These are not, I don't think these particular hospitals were private equity owned, but this is part of the story?
You know, those are three really important points, and I hope I don't forget them. But, you know, no, HSHS, Mayo, Marshfield Clinic, no, those are not private equity owned or financed organizations. They're not-for-profit facilities. They're not-for-profit systems. Does that mean they don't generate a margin or that they don't operate at a loss like they were doing seriously in the Eau Claire area? No, they have to have a margin to stay open. They have to operate in the black. But I'll tell you that, no, those three are not private equity owned. The dollars that, and the healthcare system's not perfect, which I completely understand and know, but the dollars that are going to those facilities, you know, whatever the source of those dollars are they reimbursement from Medicaid or Medicare, which is a big part of this problem. Those dollars stay within the system. They stay within the healthcare. They're not pulled out. So to answer the first question, no, at least to the extent that the dollars would be going to the $15 million I assume we're talking about, or maybe even a larger scale, that they are going to either Mayo or Marshfield Clinic, those are not going to be a part of someone's return on investment in those facilities. I think the other question was
about kind of communities preparing and keeping tabs on the health, the well-being of these important institutions.
Yeah, I, you know, that's a a good question. And sometimes these things, these sorts of situations develop pretty rapidly, more rapidly than maybe anyone would have expected 3 to 5 to 10 to 15 years ago. Again, I am indeed loath to talk about COVID, but that really did accelerate a lot of these challenges, some of which you can't address through legislation, right? So, for example, this wasn't necessarily accelerated through COVID, but our demographic challenge in the state, you know, we're a very, very aging state. And why do I bring that up here? Well, that's because that affects in the hospital world, that affects what's called payer mix. And so that payer mix means, you know, who is reimbursing the hospital for services? Is it Medicaid? Is it Medicare? Is it commercial or private insurance? And as you have a aging population like we do in Wisconsin, that means you have more and more people covered by Medicare, which, you know, sort of notoriously under reimburses for the cost of services. So that's a contributing issue. So go ahead.
Oh, I want to thanks for the call, Chris. I want to bring in some more callers. Bethany is with us in Durand. Bethany, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to share with us, Bethany?
So I have two children who have traumatic brain injuries, and it is critical that they receive speech therapy, physical and occupational therapy. And Prevea in Eau Claire was the only pediatric one in the area, and now that's closing. Services that are so essential to pediatrics. And so now I'm having to look at driving all the way to La Crosse if I can find and get on the waiting list and find someone that will take their insurance, their Forward Health, or I have to go all the way to Hudson. It's a really a critical piece that I really wish they would address in the Eau Claire area, the need for pediatric services.
Bethany, thank you. So sorry to hear that. Best to you and your kids and your family. Eric, a specialty service like that, a pediatric speech therapy, in this case, something that might get lost in the shuffle here and require patients like Bethany to go a lot further.
Yeah, and I hear Bethany's concerns. I really do. I think in a situation like this, it's almost sort of triaging, and I know that's a very subjective approach, but it's almost kind of triaging and getting input, which there was plenty of and there has been plenty of, about what needs are the most immediate. And for Bethany, obviously, her needs are immediate and now as it relates to her children. But, you know, expanding access to emergency care has kind of been, you know, issue number one or priority number one. And I think that's where some of the resources are being targeted, at least at the state level. Now, you know, the governor did sign that legislation. As your reporter noted at the beginning, he did through his line item vetoes expand the types of services that $15 million could potentially be tapped for. He also, through his line item veto, expanded the geographic region that those dollars could be used for. And so it remains to be seen how impactful the dollars will be. It's my sense that the Joint Committee on Finance, which was mentioned earlier, might have make some changes to those parameters to keep them more focused in the Chippewa Valley or Eau Claire and Chippewa counties, and maybe even more focused on certain types of services. But this is a difficult situation. There are so many needs out there. And I'll tell you, this illustrates the importance of these community safety net, not-for-profit hospitals. They, and the clinics that are connected to them. People sometimes, not Bethany, she gets it, but people sometimes view a hospital as kind of what goes on within the walls of that hospital, and don't fully, and I don't blame anyone for this, don't fully appreciate all of the services that a hospital or a health system support well outside the walls of the hospital, and what it takes to be able to do that and continue to do that, and you know, the loss of the mental health and the substance abuse treatment capacity is an example of that. And I also, you know, we've We haven't seen a hospital close, just outright close its doors in this state for probably 14 or 15 years. What we have been seeing slowly, incrementally, are our services shrinking. And not just in rural areas, but in predominantly rural areas. So loss of 5 or 6 labor and delivery programs in Wisconsin over the last 2 years, the loss, and that's not even counting Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls area, loss of behavioral health, inpatient, outpatient, substance use disorder care, those closing, and they're connected, maybe connected to or supported by a hospital. It's just getting very difficult for some hospitals in Wisconsin to continue sustaining all of those, you know, and especially when you look, look at the HSHS hospitals in Eau Claire, you know, their margin, their 2022 margins, okay, profits, if you will, were St. Joe's was -16%, Sacred Heart, -47.9%. It is, and Marshfield similarly, and as well as Mayo, not quite that bad, but in the red. I'm not, you know, crying or whining about that. What I'm saying is it becomes very, very difficult to sustain all of these services that, by the way, no one else will do, except the hospital when reimbursement and expenses are what they've been in the last few years.
And we'll have to leave it there. Eric, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That's Eric Borgerding, president and CEO of the Wisconsin Hospital Association. He talked to us about the trend of rural hospital closures across the country, with 2 in Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls scheduled to close a week from today. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We don't always have time or inspiration to create brand new, exciting dishes every night of the week, but it doesn't take a lot of time to pull together a delicious sauce. It's Food Friday, and our guest says a creative sauce could turn even the most basic dish into something new and exciting. In her new cookbook, she's got 50 options for us to try. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a sauce that you like to make and cook with and use on pretty much everything? Is it homemade or store-bought? Do you have dishes you make that are pretty much a vehicle for an excellent sauce? Or do you have a question for our guest? Maybe you've got a thing you're kind of bored of making and you need to freshen it up with something different. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Ashley Boyd is the cook, photographer, and food blogger behind Pink Owl Kitchen. She's the author of the new cookbook, Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be on.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you got into food blogging and ultimately this sauce cookbook.
Sure. So I've been cooking since I was a teenager. It's just something that I've always loved to do. I married into a really big family back in 2016, and I became like the go-to chef for all of our gatherings, anywhere from like 50 to 100 people, you know, I was cooking for sometimes. So I said, hey, why don't I try to, you know, do what I love as a career? So I started a food blog, and I found a way, you know, to make it my full-time gig. And so here I am, now a published cookbook author. So it's been a wild ride, but very rewarding.
Now, I love your philosophy in the book, and I feel like your introduction was kind of speaking to me, right? I'm one of these people. I've got a lot of things I like to make. It always comes out about the same. It's fine, but I get a little bored. Talk about your sauce philosophy and how to help people like me break out of those go-tos.
So, I mean, plenty of people find themselves in that same boat, right? You know, you can't think of another way to serve like grilled chicken or roasted vegetables or potatoes. But hey, sauce is the answer. When in doubt, add sauce. That's kind of my philosophy. you can make these sauces in bulk, you know, pack them in the freezer. You can keep them in little condiment bottles in the refrigerator and just have them on hand whenever you need to, like, zhuzh up, you know, a basic weeknight meal to get the kiddos to eat something or try something different. It's just, it's a handy little back pocket kitchen tool, I like to say this cookbook is.
And another thing I love is, you know, you could write a cookbook of sauces with hard to find ingredients and you got to stir for 5 hours to reduce it just right and stuff like that. Your recipes are really straightforward. All the ingredients I know I either have or they're even in a small grocery store. Was that really intentional by you? You wanted this to be really accessible for people?
It absolutely was very intentional. So this cookbook differs from some other sauce cookbooks you may have seen on the shelves because, like you said, it doesn't require any very hard to find ingredients, or you don't have to be like super skilled. There are no crazy techniques to make these sauces. It's very accessible for home cooks like you and I.
And on your blog, you specialize in Southern-inspired cooking, and there's some of that mm-hmm. in the cookbook, but you also reach beyond that. Can you talk about the scope you were trying to tackle in your 50 sauces?
Yes. So this cookbook was, it was a way for me to kind of break out of my comfort zone. I am a Southern girl, and Southern comfort food is what my blog is based around. But when I got approached with this concept to do globally inspired sauces, I said, hey, there's a chance for me to learn, you know, new ingredients, new ways to make dishes and, you know, flavors inspired by all over the globe. So it really took me out of my comfort zone and I had to do a lot of research. So it was fun. It was a learning experience. And now, you know, I've got like this plethora of new sauces and flavors that I can use in my cooking.
And I got to ask, you said there's a big family you married into. Are they sort of your focus group when you're trying something new?
Absolutely. whenever I've got something new that I want to see, you know, how it goes over first with the family, I'll serve it to them. And if they're like, oh, yeah, this one's good. What is this? So I'm like, okay, we'll test it again and, you know, put it out there for the masses. But, yeah, they're definitely like my little guinea pigs.
Ashley Boyd is with us on Food Friday. Her new cookbook is called Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable, Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite sauce to make, to cook with, or do you need some inspiration to make that, I don't know, baked chicken breast or that burger or that stir fry a little different this time around? You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ashley, you shared a couple recipes with us. We've got them online at WPR.org/food. Now, here's one that's coming from your Southern cooking background, the comeback sauce. This one looks like a lot of fun. Tell us about it.
Yes. So comeback sauce originated in my hometown, Jackson, Mississippi, and the name, it's a fun play on how we sometimes say see you later or a greeting like that. It's y'all come back now. So that's where the name originated, and it originated in a little restaurant in Jackson, Mississippi. And we literally, like, in Mississippi and, like, all over the Southeast, you will find this, like, on restaurant menus. We literally serve it with, like, just about everything. And it's a creamy, like, mayonnaise-based sauce. It's got a little bit of spice. The way I like to describe it to people who may have never had it is think of if remoulade, Thousand Island, ranch dressing, and barbecue sauce all had a baby, it would be comeback sauce. Yeah, it's absolutely delicious. Like I said, we put it on everything from sandwiches, French fries, fried pickles, blackened fish, fried fish, like, you name it.
And the starting point, I love this because I've been doing this a lot lately with sauces. Starting points are mayonnaise and ketchup. And there might be, you know, if you're a little snobby, what? I don't want mayonnaise or ketchup. Yeah. My sauce. Mayonnaise and ketchup are awesome together. And I'm sad that it took me so long in my life to figure that out. Could you talk about using those as a base or at least a part of sauces?
Yes. So, you know, you got people that are kind of like, you know, on either side of the fence. Mayonnaise and ketchup, come on, you know, really. But I'm telling you, in the comeback sauce and in a lot of other sauces, it just does something really magical. And then you have other ingredients in this sauce. Like I use sriracha. A lot of my Mississippi friends would say, you know, that's blasphemy because they prefer chili sauce and comeback sauce in a lot of comeback sauce recipes, but I use sriracha. And then you've got Worcestershire sauce, which adds that delicious umami flavor, fresh lemon juice, whole grain mustard. You've got some fresh garlic, fresh herbs, parsley, and then you can season it up however you like. I love paprika, onion powder, and garlic powder. So combine all that with the mayonnaise and the ketchup. You've got a creamy base, and then there's a bunch of like zing, you know, in there as well. So it's a really delicious sauce.
All right. Now, where is this sauce going? What are your favorite dishes to put this on?
Everything. Like, I eat it on my scrambled eggs. Like when I say everything, I mean everything. I keep me some in the refrigerator in a squeeze bottle, but probably my favorite thing, if I had to pick one thing, would be hush puppies. I love hush puppies with comeback sauce.
And, you know, we're making maybe a big batch of this. How long can we refrigerate this kind of thing for after we mix it?
So you can keep this in the refrigerator for about a week. You probably go up to 10 days. But the great thing about it is make you a huge batch, put you some in the squeeze bottle in the refrigerator, and then freeze the rest. And then just thaw it out a couple days before. And then you can just keep doing that to cycle through that batch you've got in the freezer.
Excellent. So it freezes good. Do a lot of the sauces in the book freeze well?
All of them do. So in making this cookbook, you know, that was something that I got to find out firsthand because I had so much sauce, right? So I was freezing it and I'm like, oh, I wonder if this will be good, you know, and I thought out. And every sauce in the cookbook freezes well. So that's great.
Okay, now comeback sauce sounds like it would be a great sandwich condiment as well. I love sandwiches. What are some of the other sauces you like to put together that are great sandwich condiments?
Okay, so for sandwiches, I would say my roasted red pepper tzatziki sauce. It's so good on like wraps and sandwiches. I've also got a Southwest ranch in there that's really good on sandwiches. If you want to go the herby route, probably the basil pistachio pesto. It's really good on like a fish sandwich, chicken sandwich. There's a ton more, but those are the ones that kind of stick out in my mind.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Ashley Boyd about her new cookbook. It's called Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable, Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. Got a couple of those recipes online at WPR.org/food, including the comeback sauce we were just talking about. Now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you had a special sauce at a restaurant that keeps you going back? Have you tried to recreate it at home? How did that go? Do you have a dish you make all the time that you're getting kind of bored of? You're looking for a way to mix it up, spice it up, do something different. Ashley might have some suggestions for you. Is there a secret sauce that you use in your cooking all the time? Maybe that other people ask you the recipe for. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up our Food Friday conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're picking up our conversation with Ashley Boyd, food blogger at Pink Owl Kitchen, and we're talking about her new cookbook. It's called Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear about your favorite sauce, condiment, salad dressing, marinade, the go-to maybe for grilling season? That's coming up. Well, it's been pretty warm. Maybe it's here already. Join in now at 800-642-1234 with your favorites or your questions. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ashley, I just looked at our chat. You've inspired a lot of conversation among the Central Time producers here. Colleen says, I sometimes eat salad just so I can have Green Goddess dressing. Well, and there's Green Goddess dressing in your book. What goes into making, I've bought it in packages, never made it myself. What goes into Green Goddess?
So Green Goddess is, it's a creamy sauce with a ton of herbs. So there's a lot of flavor in it. The one in the cookbook, it's really zesty. So this one, you can use, you want a creamy base. I like Greek yogurt. You do a ton of herbs, baby spinach, parsley, dill, basil, green onions, fresh lemon juice is a must, as well as lemon zest. You can also use a different citrus if you like. Orange is really good. There's also anchovies in Green Goddess dressing. Well, in some of them, you can omit it if anchovies aren't your thing, but they really add something like really special to Green Goddess, that kind of briny flavor. And then, of course, extra virgin olive oil to kind of bring it all together. So Green Goddess, it's absolutely delicious. It's one of my favorites as well.
And do you have other favorite salad dressings?
So I like a kind of like vinegary based salad. Mm-hmm. So if you give me something like an Italian red wine vinaigrette, any type of vinaigrette, I'm there for it.
Excellent. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Oh, not quite ready yet. We'll get to them in just a minute. Well, let's check out the other recipe you gave us, Ashley, a coconut chili crisp sauce. Crisp and sauce. That's interesting. What's going on there?
Mm-hmm. So this one is really, really fun. Coconut chili crisp, you may see it sometimes referred to as chili oil or chili sauce. So it became like super popular here in the past few years. And it's inspired by Chinese cuisine. And it is a sauce. You basically, you simmer a bunch of ingredients in oil to get them really crispy and browned. And then, so what we use in ours is chopped shallots, and then we add some star anise pods and cinnamon stick to give it some extra flavor. It just adds that little something extra you can't quite put your finger on. You're like, oh my God, it's so delicious. And then unsweetened coconut flakes, red pepper flakes, and there's a little bit of soy sauce in it, as well as a tad bit of sugar and a little bit of salt, just to bring everything together. You simmer that in the oil, and then you kind of let it sit there and crisp up. And you can put it on like just about anything. Think ice cream. Yes, ice cream. Noodles, rice, vegetables, potatoes. That's another one that we keep. We've got some in the refrigerator right now. Like, we keep it on hand. My husband, as soon as we get low, he's like, we need some more chili crisp. I'm like, okay, I got you.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Maggie is with us in Brookfield. Maggie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, years ago, my mother-in-law used to make a ham loaf, and with that ham loaf recipe came a sauce. It was a mustard sauce, and I make that mustard sauce, and it's in my refrigerator all the time, because no matter how mediocre your meatloaf is, putting that mustard sauce on makes it taste really good. So I have that in my refrigerator all the time.
What else is in there apart from mustard? Is this one of those sort of mustard, brown sugar, glazy sort of things?
Right. Mustard, egg yolks, some oil, Worcestershire sauce, onions, that sort of thing. And it's the yellow mustard that you buy in the store,
sure.
the bright yellow stuff.
Maggie, thanks a lot for sharing that. It sounds delicious. And Ashley, mustard is a frequent co-star in your recipes. It's in that comeback sauce, I think. And you're using whole grain mustard. What kind of, it's a little different, I think, than the yellow mustard Maggie's talking about. What are you looking for in the mustard you mix into sauces?
Yeah, so you can certainly substitute the yellow mustard that Maggie was just referring to if you don't have any whole grain mustard on hand. But the mustard that I love to use, it's got a little more of a, what's the word? I don't know. It's got a stronger flavor. My husband is like, oh, that's the strong mustard. I'm like, yeah, it's a strong mustard. But it's got, I think there's a little bit of like white wine in it, and it's got like the little seeds in it. It's just, it's got a stronger flavor. And what I like to tell people, if you can get your hands on some Creole mustard, it's even better. It's like a whole grain mustard, but it's got a little bit of spice to it. And I think there's like a little bit of like Worcestershire sauce in there, but it's really good. It's made by Zatarain's. And if you can find it like on Amazon, or if you have any markets there that may have it on hand, you've got to try it out in the remoulade. It's so good.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Ashley, we've got a whole mustard museum here in Wisconsin.
Hundreds,
I'm going to say maybe thousands. Yeah. And actually, another reason to come up here, maybe one of our producers is wondering, you know about fried cheese curds down there? This is big in Wisconsin, like deep fried cheese curds.
Cheese curds. Okay. I have not heard of those.
Okay, so take like squeaky cheese curds, batter, deep fry them. So you got to come to Wisconsin sometime. Here, so for fried food in general, what are some of your favorite dipping sauces?
Okay, number one's got to be the comeback sauce, which we've been talking about a lot.
Sure.
Comeback sauce, remoulade, ranch dressing, any type of like flavored ranch. Like I love an avocado ranch, Southwest ranch, which is in the book. So yeah, any type of like creamy ranch type thing, I'm here for it.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Ashley Boyd about her new cookbook. It's called Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. We heard from Samantha, who called in on the road, says she loves ketchup and mayonnaise together. I'm right there with you, Samantha. She wants to know if there are other ways to jazz it up. Well, Samantha, if you're still listening, WPR.org/food, you can find that comeback sauce. It is heavily jazzed up, mayonnaise and ketchup. Ashley, are there other directions to take our fry sauce or mayonnaise and ketchup and do something different with them?
So there's this sauce I'm like, I don't have like a written recipe for it, but it's a mayonnaise and ketchup base. I call it like just my Cajun dipping sauce, but it's that. I add a little bit of sour cream in there as well, some seasoning, some hot sauce. I mean, you can do a lot with mayonnaise and ketchup as a base. You know, just have fun. Get in the kitchen and have fun and taste it. If it tastes disgusting, throw it out and start a new batch.
Now, are there sauces that you have found are good for kids? Maybe the picky eater type kids, or maybe picky eater grownups that gets them to try some foods they might not like without that good sauce.
So I have a 2-year-old.
So there you go.
I have a 2-year-old son. Yeah. And he is very, very picky. So I can get him to try lots of different things if I add a little bit of sauce. let's see. What's the most recent thing? There was a broccoli. The kid does not want to eat broccoli to save his life. So if I serve broccoli with it sounds like it doesn't really go together, but he loves it. The guava barbecue sauce, which is a recipe in my cookbook. If I serve the broccoli with the guava barbecue sauce, oh, it's like the best thing in the world. Serve the broccoli by itself, not so much. But yeah, there are tons of sauces in here that could get picky eaters to eat things that they normally would not pick up and eat.
Well, I want to finish up by talking about the last section in your book, dessert sauces, which I honestly didn't expect to find in there. What kind of stuff are you putting out there for us to close our meals with a great dessert with?
So you've got some things that you may be familiar with, like you've got creme anglaise. I know that sounds fancy, but it's really not hard to make at all. You've got a salted caramel sauce in there, which is one of my favorites. And then you've got some that, you know, you may not have heard of before, like the blackberry basil coulis. That one is so good because you've got the sweet and tart blackberries, and then you've got basil, which gives it that herby flavor. And, you know, of course, some sugar and some lemon juice. That one's really good on pancakes, on ice cream, on bread pudding. Let me see. What's another one that I really love in there? Oh, the brown sugar peach sauce. That's one of my favorite things. We love bread pudding in the South, so... bread pudding is like a suggestion for almost all of the dessert sauces, but I love the brown sugar peach sauce over bread pudding. It is to die for.
I love bread pudding. I made so much of it. My kids were making fun of me like during COVID. Like that was, maybe it was my coping tool or something. I made, and they hate it. They want nothing to do with bread pudding. Do your kids eat it?
Oh, wow. My son loves it. He loves bread pudding. He tears it up. It's one of his favorite desserts. So,
excellent. Well, Ashley, are there any new sauces you're kind of experimenting on with your lab subjects and your family?
I haven't tried anything recently. I'm trying to think here. I mean, I'm always mixing up some kind of sauce, to be honest with you, but I have not done like a written recipe for anything yet. We're always whipping up sauces in the kitchen. So it's like it's constant.
Ashley, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a bunch of fun. Thank you.
Ashley Boyd blogs at Pink Owl Kitchen. We talked with her on Food Friday today about her new cookbook. It's called Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. Real straightforward stuff. You can find 2 of those recipes, try them at home, over at WPR.org/food. We got the comeback sauce. Do a lot with that. And then that coconut chili crisp sauce. Again, they're both online at WPR.org/food. And if you have a favorite sauce, still time for you to share it. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And man, oh man, if you love that ketchup mayo combination by itself or dressed up like that comeback sauce like I do, love to hear about it. Let us know what you do with it. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Wisconsin's legislature is wrapping up its session, and there are some high-profile items still on the table that didn't end up making it through committees or to full votes. Find out what did and didn't get through this session. Join in with your questions, and if you want to see some things resolved, PFAS legislation, among other things. That's coming up Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Speaking of cooking, I just moved to a new place a couple weeks back. The kitchen, it's all unpacked and ready to rock, but I'm still figuring out exactly how I'm going to use it when I cook, because here's what's happening. I get a couple things out of the fridge, put them over there on that counter, get out a cutting board and knife and set them on a different counter, get out something else, put it by the stove. This isn't like a huge kitchen with tons of space, but still, somehow, when I actually go to start cooking, I've spread stuff out in like three or four different places. Then I got to pick one spot and get it all back together. I'm not what you'd call efficient in the first place, but this is above and beyond for even for me. Eventually, I'll figure out a good kitchen workflow. In the meantime, if I'm making dinner for you, tack on an extra 5-10 minutes before it's going to be ready. Kitchen news you can't use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
This is a story of the Bad River people and their home on Lake Superior.
Our people have been here for millennia.
They've had to fight for who they are.
And the Ojibwe have been resisting ever since.
That's from the trailer for the new documentary film Bad River, which follows the history of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. The movie premieres this weekend at theaters around the state and the country. I talked to two members of the Bad River Band yesterday to talk about the new documentary and what it means for the tribe. But first, I talked to the director of Bad River, filmmaker Mary Mazzio. And now, what is it that put the Bad River fight for sovereignty, the pipeline story, and so much more on your radar as a filmmaker?
So, honestly, I was called almost at the beginning of my career by a Native American high school basketball coach. And he could not get any of his high school athletes recruited to D1 schools. And he said to me at the time, could you ever do a project to help dispel some of those preconceived stereotypes? And I was very young in my career, but after our last film, I said, now I think is the time. And subsequently, I was introduced to former chairman Mike Wiggins, and he invited me to the Bad River Reservation and said, why don't you come out and do some, we're going to do some canoe diplomacy. I had no idea what that meant, but I went out and, you know, it started from there.
And then you started, I think, telling the story of the pipeline, but as you yes. were filming and talking to people, it grew into a lot more in this very much bigger story.
Exactly. I mean, I thought here you have this small group of people with monumental effort and a great personal cost, fighting to protect a precious resource, Lake Superior, not for themselves, but for all of us. And as a recovering lawyer, I was really drawn into that sort of initial conflict. And when I started interviewing elders, they were happy to talk about the conflict, but they said, wait. Do you realize what happened 7 years ago with the mining battle and the open pit mine that was going to be put in the Pinokies? And oh, by the way, we want to talk about what our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents have done over the course of history to fight back. And so this turned into a historical retrospective because that's really what the elders wanted to talk about, and they controlled the flow of the film.
Can you talk about how you tell that story? You're juggling a lot of voices from the Bad River Band themselves and your narrators. How did you put all these pieces together?
I'll tell you, I had an amazing partner in Allison Abner. Allison wrote for Narcos and West Wing. She happens to be the descendant of the Stockbridge Muncie Band. I also had another writing partner in Alec Sokolow. Alec wrote Toy Story. So you rightly point out that you've got the historical angle, you've got the current lawsuit. We have amazing narration by Quanah Chasing Horse and three-time Academy Award nominee Edward Norton. And so it was a real test, quite honestly, Rob. How to weave this together, how to keep it moving, what stories were, there were so many compelling stories, and the elders zipped open their hearts and had extraordinary generosity of spirit to really share this ethos of standing up for what you believe in and fighting the fight on behalf of all of us.
This will premiere around Wisconsin, but not just Wisconsin. What are your hopes for taking what some people might look at as a very local story to a much wider audience?
Well, you know, listen, this is a great counterpoint to Killers of the Flower Moon, right? Where you have a lens of cowboys with murder and mayhem. And then here you have 100 years later, a story about oil and money and water, but told through the lens of the Bad River Band. But that's really a prism for all Native communities that have fought similar challenges. And I think it's a piece of history that many Americans don't understand. And frankly, this battle is one that has been really fought under cover of darkness. And to have light on this issue, it's a really extraordinary act of selflessness, as I said before, that the Bad River Band is fighting on behalf of all Americans. And as a postscript to that, former chairman Mike Wiggins, I heard him speak just about 2 weeks ago, and he said, you know, what we're doing here as a community, we're patriots. It is our civic duty to fight for what he calls the freshwater stronghold of this country.
Mary, before I let you go, how can people see the film? Talk us through the basics.
Oh, we are opening. Thank you, Rob. We're opening in 12 cities in multiplexes. Highly unusual for a documentary, and we're thrilled to have our partners at AMC Theaters. And so if your listeners go to badriverfilm.com, they can hit the dates page. You can go get tickets. We are sharing 50% of the profits of the project with the band. And so if any of your listeners cannot get to the theater, we'd love for them to buy seats early and often.
Mary, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
All right, Rob. Thank you for having us.
That's Mary Mazzeo, documentary film director, founder and CEO of 50 Eggs, Inc. Her new film, Bad River, comes to theaters, as you just heard, on March 15th. Now we'll dig deeper into the story here with us, Liz Arbuckle, senior councilwoman on the Bad River Tribal Council. Liz, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And Ashley Stone is a former member of the Bad River Tribal Council. Ashley appears in the documentary film Bad River. Ashley, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Liz, can you start us off by talking about your hopes for this documentary, sharing the story of the Bad River Band with the rest of the world?
Absolutely. We're all excited. I'm not in the film. It was just kind of a scheduling thing. It was just a really busy time in my personal life with kids going to college and whatnot. But I'm now on Tribal Council. I wasn't before. And we are on 100% Team Bad River. We are so excited to be, for all the council people are very excited to be a part of this, to be helping teach people about Bad River, teach people about our culture, our history. We do a lot of wonderful things up here. It's about the people, the land, the animals. You know, I grew up on my reservation. I moved away, went to college, did some things, and now I'm back, and it's an honor to serve for my tribal community 100% and to be able to share why we love this place, why this is important. And this isn't a new thing. We've been fighting these battles for centuries. Really centuries. You can go back as far as the 1850 removal order when they were trying to kick the Ojibwe out of Wisconsin. And our Chief Buffalo and other delegates paddled, walked, took a train, whatever it took to get to Washington, D.C. to preserve our land, to preserve this homeland. And from that became we got the 1854 treaty, which established Bad River and some of the other reservations. So this is just another chapter in how committed we are to preserving, loving, and giving back to the land that preserves and has loved us for centuries.
And Ashley, you and many others, other members of the Bad River Band, share your stories in this documentary. How important is it to you that, you know, this is a story being told by you and the fellow members of the Bad River Band?
Yeah, at the time of filming, I was on tribal council and was asked to be a part of the documentary. And I really thought it was important to shed light on our rich cultural heritage and the current, you know, contemporary challenges that we face, that the Bad River community faces, and really giving a voice to our story and our struggles, particularly in the face of ongoing environmental and social injustices that we see, you know, repeatedly. And it was great to be part of this documentary and shed light on that.
And Liz, this story isn't done. We've talked on the show in the past about the ongoing legal battle over this pipeline. We don't need to dig super deep into the back and forth in the courts, but can you talk about what still needs to be resolved in this ongoing saga?
Well, yeah, exactly. It is still definitely an ongoing saga. The federal, we've got a couple of things going on where the federal agreed that with the band that the pipeline is creating a risk to the meander. And of course, that's what a lot of us are very concerned about. We have to preserve that. There's some questions about their trespassing, that they haven't respected tribal sovereignty or our treaty rights. And that is another theme we will see emerge here, is that it's protecting our treaty rights and sovereign rights.
And Ashley, Liz mentioned a few moments ago her love for the community, for the land, for the water there. Can you talk a little bit about that, the love you and others feel for this community you're part of?
Absolutely. I love Bad River. I love Mushkazebe with all my heart. And I know the community feels the same way. I know the people feel the same way. I know that you don't have to be a tribal member, but you can just be from Bad River and know the power of Lake Superior and really appreciate and take in awe of that. This film really brings that to light.
And Liz, are you going to be going to some of the premieres when the Bad River documentary comes to theaters?
Absolutely. Milwaukee friends, family, and neighbors, please come and see me at Mayfair Mall. I'm going to be doing a welcome address at the theater on Friday for the shows. Secretary Bob Hull will be at Minneapolis. Councilman Dan Wiggins will be in Chicago. Horst Livingston, who is in the film, will be at Madison. So we've got different folks. Like I said, we're Team Bad River. We're very excited. Please come to the movie theaters. There's still tickets available in many of the sites. I'll do an address, and I would love to meet with you, shake your hand, and share with you what I can share with you about Bad River.
And Ashley, as we wrap up, what are you hoping the rest of the world takes away from Bad River?
I really hope that everyone can see how proud and empowering this film is for the community and our story being told, and really amplifying our voices and making sure that our perspective is shared with everyone, with a wider audience. And I feel that it will be something that's shared worldwide.
And I did want to add one thing. Mm-hmm. We're not the most tech savvy tribe on the planet, but we're getting there. And we have just created a new website called defendthebadriver.org, which is a lot about these issues. So please visit that site. That's going to be continuing to be updated. So we'll have more information there. And you can also follow us on Facebook.
Ashley and Liz, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Yeah. Bye.
Thank you.
That was Liz Arbuckle, senior councilwoman on the Bad River Tribal Council, and Ashley Stone, former member of the Bad River Tribal Council. We also heard from Mary Mazzio, documentary filmmaker, been talking about the new documentary film Bad River, coming to theaters starting tonight. You can learn more at badriverfilm.com. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A warm and dry winter has meant wildfire season is starting early in Wisconsin. A recent report from a national government agency says that most areas in Wisconsin have an above-normal potential for wildfires in March and April. We're already seeing this in the numbers reported by the Department of Natural Resources and warnings being given out by the DNR. Ron Schneider is a cooperative fire specialist at the Wisconsin DNR. Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me on the show.
Ron, I don't think we have any huge fires, but it sounds like we have a lot of fires compared to, say, average years. What are we seeing going on around the state?
Well, we're seeing a very early fire season this year. We've seen a number of fires that started in February, where we usually don't see our fire season start until really after St. Patrick's Day, after the snow melts. So it's already busy for us.
How has our weirdly mild and warm winter helped set the stage for this early wildfire season?
Yes, it was a mild winter. We didn't see the normal snowfall that we usually see, so that really led to two problems. One is our ongoing drought, really in the northern 80% of the state. Another factor is the lack of snow. Usually the snow melts, in southern Wisconsin in February and early March, but the northern part of the state is still under feet of snow. What we're experiencing this year is really the whole state has been snow-free since January. A lot of the state didn't have really much snow cover at all.
Now, that's the conditions. What tends to be the spark? What are the most common causes of a wildfire flaring up in the state?
So 90% or more of our fires are caused by humans or people in one way or another. Our number one cause of wildfires is debris burning. So that can be someone maybe just wants to get rid of their pile of leaves and they start up, burn a leaf pile or brush, or they're burning, cardboard or refuse in a barrel. Debris burning every year is our number one cause of fires.
And so when we've got conditions like this, what are the current warnings from DNR? What are you asking people to do, or I guess mostly to not do?
Yeah, of course. We're asking people to not burn. It's the worst time of year for fires. Most of our fires in Wisconsin are in spring, in March, April, and May. And so if you can put off burning of, your leaves or your brush until the lawns turn green in June and July, when the fire danger is low, that will really lower the chances of any of that burning causing a fire.
And yeah, is this a unique situation where we've got kind of the drier, dead fuel from last year's vegetation, but way earlier than the new, as you said, green stuff comes up and is less of a fire risk?
Yes, exactly. Most of our fires, although we call them forest fires, most of them start in grass. And in maybe in cornfields. And if you look at the grass in your yard right now or the fields, they're brown. And they're brown because they're dry. So until your grass turns green, until the fields are plowed and planted, those are all a place for fires to start. And then, of course, the fires from there spread from there with wind and carry into the forest fuels.
And can you talk about the kind of damage wildfires do here in Wisconsin? Obviously, we might think of out west where the big fires are, and that's mostly true. What kind of damage do we see here in the state, though, from a bad wildfire year?
Of course, the biggest threat for our wildfires is human life and injury, to the fires. And we've already had injuries. We've experienced that this year already. The second really problem we look at is the fires that spread and then maybe ignite a building. They may burn, next to a garage, start a garage or a barn or even a house on fire. And then ironically, the last threat for us with forest fires is the forest burning. But that, of course, causes damage too.
Talking to Ron Schneider, cooperative fire specialist at the Wisconsin DNR, about an early start to wildfire season here in Wisconsin. Ron, can you tell us about the work you do working with local fire departments to be prepared to contain these wildfires?
Yes, the DNR is really just one small part of all the forces that are out there to combat these fires. In Wisconsin, we have around 825 fire departments. And whenever there is a fire in Wisconsin, in our DNR fire protection areas, the fire department and the DNR both respond to those fires. They're paged at the same time. And so it's important for us to work together. We work together on the fires. We train together during the winter months or the off season. And then, of course, we have a lot of other partners, too, like nonprofit groups like the Nature Conservancy, our tribal partners like Menominee Tribe. And then our federal partners, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Forest Service. So there's a lot of pieces of the puzzle that we work on all year, because we need to work together in spring.
fire departments can be pretty busy even without wildfires going on. How much does a big year for wildfires like this one stretch our resources thin?
Well, I know in DNR we have every available person working this weekend. That's all of our full-time staff, and then we also have a lot of part-time staff that we will bring in on high and very high fire danger days. And then, of course, our fire departments, those that are full-time, are staffed. And a lot of our volunteer fire departments in the state are really on their toes on these very bad fire days, ready to respond to fires. So it's a 24/7 system that we have in place to respond to most of the fires.
And what tends to be the case here in Wisconsin? Do we get very many big fires? I can think of a few in the last 20 years or so, or are we dealing with lots of little ones kind of spread out?
This time of year, we have a lot of starts from the fires. In a normal year, we see our largest fires in late April or early May, where we see like the big crown fires in our pine plantations and things like that. That we may see that really in late March, early April, that might be beginning this year, just because of how dry it is. We may see prolonged conditions where we have the potential for large fires until we get some significant rainfall.
For people who want to keep up with fire hazard, whether they want to burn debris at some point this year or they're camping or what have you, all the different reasons we might set something in a hopefully controlled fire, where can we go? What's our one-stop shop to keep track of our local conditions and burn bans and warnings?
The best place is our DNR website. We update the fire danger daily, and that is at dnr.wisconsin.gov, or you can use any search engine and type in Wisconsin DNR. And this time of year, the first page that comes on our website is a link to our fire danger. And we update that every day. And for example, for this weekend, for the Madison area, the southern, I would say 20% of the state is low fire danger because of the rain we had yesterday. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the state is on high and very high fire danger.
And so if people are more careful about their fires and pay attention to that, like how much do you think it would cut back on the workload there at the DNR and fire departments around the state when it comes to wildfires?
The best thing people can do now is just not burn. I know we always recommend, like, if you're going to have a campfire or if you're going to burn debris, make sure you get a permit or the proper permit, depending on where you live, and then have a shovel or have water available. But with the really windy days that we are seeing now, a shovel and a bucket of water probably isn't going to be enough. The fires just spread faster than you can physically put them out and contain them. So we really recommend this time of year, just don't burn until we're past this peak fire danger time of year.
And Ron, this time of year, as we wrap up, are you and your colleagues watching the weather closely and hoping for some rain?
Yes, everyone is doing their rain dance, and I know, the Madison area, really the southern counties in the state, got some beneficial rain yesterday, but the rest of the state is dry. We'd like to get rain. We're looking at the long-range forecast, and it looks very dry. And not only is it dry, but it's going to get cold again, which really keeps the grass from turning green, so it's just going to prolong our fire season.
Ron, we'll leave it there. Thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you very much.
That's Ron Schneider, cooperative fire specialist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He was with us for a look at why Wisconsin's wildfire season is starting so early this year and what it means looking ahead to spring and summer. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, with dangerous levels of lead found in some applesauce and cinnamon products, we'll dig into the U.S. food safety system, how it works, and when it sometimes falls short. And when someone is looking for mental health care, where do they start? We'll dig into the mental health care system and get some practical advice for making often difficult decisions. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.